You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Welcome to this episode of the Business of Practice podcast, where we focus on the business and human sides of equine veterinary medicine. In this episode, we're going to talk with Dr. Charlotte LaCroix about minority offers of equity shares to associates. I'm your host, Dr. Amy Grice, business consultant and former equine practice owner. The Business of Practice podcast is brought to you in 2026 by Care Credit. Dr. LaCroix earned her Doctor of Veterinary Medicine from UC Davis in 1988, after which she worked as an equine practitioner until her love of advocacy led her to earning a law degree at the University of Pennsylvania in 1997. Her professional career has been dedicated to helping veterinarians and other members of the industry navigate the quagmire of risks and challenges within the veterinary profession. Dr. LaCroix owns Veterinary Business Advisors, Incorporated, a national consulting firm for veterinary business and legal issues. She has over 20 years of experience assisting veterinarians and lectures extensively on business and legal issues, as well as facilitates continuing education seminars nationwide. Dr. LaCroix volunteers for organizations including the AVMA, AAHA, AAEP, the New Jersey VMA, and Pennsylvania VMA. She's currently a board member of the Veterinary Innovation Council and the Veterinary Virtual Care Association. Welcome, Dr. LaCroix. It's so good to have you with us today.
Thank you, Dr. Grice, for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Recently, the Veterinary Information Network, or VIN as we all know it, recently published an article on the offering of minority shares to associates in which you were quoted. You also gave a talk on this topic at VMX in January. Can you tell us about the different ways that these equity offers are made, like as a signing bonus, for instance, or even as an opportunity to purchase?
Absolutely. And I've been speaking on this topic, and it involves mainly corporate consolidator opportunities. So when associates work for a practice that's owned by some form of corporate consolidator as opposed to a private practice, although we are seeing private practitioners and particularly larger practices begin adopting these same incentives. And they are typically very complicated, very nuanced, and supported by extensive documentation, sometimes 50 to 80 pages, which most associates certainly are not going to read through. And it's difficult for an associate to retain an attorney that specializes in these type of agreements. This is really a specialty area, because it's complicated language, to review and advise on what you're getting here. And generally, the associate has very limited ability to change the terms because these are agreements that, of course, the employer, you know, wants to provide evenly, and it's also easier to implement. But at a minimum, associates should know what they're entering into and ensure that whatever their expectations are appropriate expectations given the various aspects of the transaction or the transaction documents. So, we've put some questions together that people should generally ask. So one of the first questions is, what type of equity? So equity means like stock, right, that you would typically see in the stock market. But because different entities like limited liability companies have units versus stock, doesn't really matter. Equity is some form of ownership in a company. And there's basically two levels that this is offered. One is what we call it the platform company. So this is equity in the company that owns all the veterinary practices. It's considered a platform because they're the mama bear, if you will, if they own all the practices. The other type is what we call in our industry a joint venture. So this is where you would own equity in the practice that you're working at. So it's at the very micro level, if you will. Generally, when we see these as part of employment agreements, they're at the platform level. They are not at the joint venture level, although joint venture levels are opportunities that may be available. But you have to ask that question. But I'm going to focus on the ones where it's at the platform level. So here you're owning a piece of a business, you're owning a very, very, very small piece of the business. And if the business does well, you would do well, presumably. If the business does not do well or is flatlined, you may not, certainly do so well. And employers want to provide equity to associates for multiple reasons. One of the reasons is to hope that the associate feels like they have skin in the game so that they might work a little bit harder. They might go beyond what somebody might otherwise do because they feel that, well, if I help this company, then the company will do well and I might be able to get more money from the value of my stock. And there's really two ways you can get money. Is one is distributions, so profit distributions. And then the other one is if the equity increases in value and you're able to sell your equity, then you get increased value is there. So that's one question is, do I get distributions? And what are my chances that the value is going to go up? And by the way, what is the value of my units? So how you acquire those units will vary. So this is why we see them often in terms of a signing bonus or retention, where the associate doesn't actually have to put out any money. They might have a signing bonus that's, you know, they might get $50,000 in units. And the issue is, do they get them all up front and they're theirs and then they are valued of whatever they are? That's unusual. Typically, they would have to stay a certain period of time, typically a 5-year period, in order to have full ownership of all those units. And this is where we get into what type of ownership. Do I get the ownership on a pro rata basis? So if it's over 5 years, I get 20% a year. Or do I have to stay the full 5 years? And that's what they call cliff vesting, like you're on a cliff. And in which case, then you get the full, you know, you get your full 50. You get your full, all your units. And that is that question is, during the time, do you get any profits from it? Typically, you do not. So it's really an equity investment. So the investment, the value of it comes in the form of whether the value of the company goes, you know, certainly up or down. And of course, the other consideration, which is very important, is, okay, well, let's say I stay my 5 years. Or let's say I stay 3 years and it's a pro rata vesting. How do I get my value out? You know, do I, you know, if it was worth $50,000 at the time I signed my employment agreement, when, you know, how do I get it out? And there's two important questions. Is number one, how is it valued when you do get it out? And two, when do you get it out? And most people think that they might get it once their employment ends, and that's not actually the case. Many times, the ability of the associate to get out their investment, in addition to meeting whatever requirements of, you know, retention or whatever, is they reference some kind of triggering event. And a triggering event is when the company is bought by another investor, for example. Now, again, these are just nuances. I'm just giving some kind of general rules or general pattern recognition based on the numerous types of agreements we've seen over the years from different companies. So companies can have differences, but at the end of the day, you still need to ask the same questions no matter who the company is and get a definitive answer. Because this is the other thing. You don't necessarily get a definitive answer. And you should get the answer in writing. And even best, have them show you in the agreement where it says that answer to whatever question you are you know, certainly that you're asking. So that question is like, okay, when do I get my investment now? And then they have a triggering event. Well, the triggering event, you know, they might tell you it'll be 3 years from now. That's what our plan is. Or it'll be 5 years from now. That's what our plan is. Or whatever that is. That's just speculation. So just keep that in mind. And if you leave, certainly before the vesting, you could lose, generally you'll lose all of it, even if you did vest, you know, certainly along the way. And if you leave before, like after you vested, but before the triggering event, you still might have value to that equity, or you might lose it, you know, certainly, as well. And the key here is, so yes, you could own a piece of this equity for a very long time, even after you've left, and you're just hoping that one day it's going to turn into something. And how will it be valued when it turns into something? That's typically, not arbitrary, but it's some mechanism that they control. And then the other thing, you might assume that you get paid out in cash. Well, not necessarily. They could give you cash, or they could pay you out over time under a promissory note, or they could do rollover stock. So in other words, though, that agreement might say that the triggering event might require you to roll over all that equity into the new company's equity. So it's kind of like just pushing it down the road where you actually get no cash, or maybe half of it is eligible for cash and half of it is eligible for rollover. So the thing here is that the money that you think that you might be getting when you sign your employment agreement, you may never see it, or it may be a very long time that you see it, or it might be devalued by the time you see it, and you may forfeit it certainly along the way, and that might depend on how you are terminated. So if you voluntarily quit, you might forfeit it, or if you're terminated for cause, you might forfeit it, or what happens if I die, or what happens if I'm disabled, how I leave my employment, you know, basically varied. And then the other reason why a lot of these companies want you to have, or would like you to have these, is for the non-compete, because many times there's a non-competition with these equity documents that is far more enforceable than through your employment agreement, even in states like California that don't even enforce non-competes. They could be enforceable with these equity documents. And these non-competes could be far more onerous than the ones in your employment agreement. Your employment agreement might say you can't work for 2 years or 1 year within 35 miles of that premises. Your equity document could say that you cannot work within 35 miles from any location for so long as you own the equity. And remember, I said you might leave employment but still own equity. Guess what? That non-compete applies because you are still an owner. And there you are knocking on the door of the company saying, I want my stock out, or forget it, just take it, leave it. Well, we've had situations where I've had an associate or two or three say, Charlotte, I just want to give it up. I don't want the equity. Give it up. I just want to get out of the non-compete that's in the equity documents. And the companies are more than happy to take back the stock. But guess what? You're still bound by that non-compete from the date you no longer own the stock. Now, us in the legal community think, we can't see how that would be enforceable. That's just so onerous. There's such, like, I know, when you own Microsoft, do you sign a non-compete that says you can't build computers? No. I mean, it's not exactly the same scale. I get it. But the analogy is there. But here's the thing. Are you going to go up against Goliath and challenge their 50-page operating agreement and hire an attorney and the legal fees to do that? Probably not. And they have internal legal departments that can just, you know, drag these things on for quite a long time. So those are some of the high level items, Dr. Grice, that I wanted, you know, your listeners to just be sensitive to.
The Business of Practice podcast is brought to you by Care Credit. Care Credit keeps equine veterinarians at the heart of care by providing horse owners with simple, budget-friendly financing options. By helping to bridge the gap between costs and care, Care Credit supports healthy financial relationships between veterinarians and their clients. Clients have a flexible way to pay over time for all types of care, and practices get paid in 2 business days. It's a payment experience everyone can feel good about.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like there's really
any positive aspects of such an offer? And if you were given the choice of having a $50,000 signing bonus with actual money, other than saying, holy cow, don't spend it, because you might have to pay it back after, you know. But is there anything at all positive for an associate about this?
I think there is. I mean, I think it's a gamble, right? So if you're willing to go to Las Vegas and willing to lose all of it, but, you know, if you were on the cusp of one of these triggering events, you know, you could turn 50,000 into maybe 150,000 or zero, right? I think what we have to look at closely is what other strings are attached that influence this investment that could influence my career moving forward. In my opinion, if these agreements had no non-competes, then the risk is truly gambling. In other words, I'm taking the, if something happens, great. Doesn't happen, great. If it doesn't happen for 10 years, great. If I never make money along the way, great. I don't care. I'm just, you know, I'm just going to do it because why not? But the problem is that what are the strings attached once I no longer cease to be employed? And then the circumstances of how you cease to be employed could certainly impact the value of some of these investments. There may be penalty discounts applied, for example, if you're terminated for cause, or if you just out resign because, you know, your partner got relocated to Montana and you need to go to Montana. And those things happen in life, right? So I think those are the nuances. I just don't want people signing things under false expectations.
Yeah, I understand. And boy, it's so important because the 40 to 50 pages, 60 pages of documents, it's crazy. People have no idea what they're signing because it's in a foreign language, frankly.
Oh, it gives me a headache to read those documents. Yeah. They're very complicated. You know, takes an hour for every 10 pages. It's tough.
Yeah, exactly. So I've seen associates in the equine side be given the opportunity to purchase small numbers of shares, like, you know, 1%, 2%, maybe 4% in a large practice where the practice owners are getting ready to sell to corporate. It often seems like that's just locking them in to make sure that they get the corporate sale. And again, those documents really matter. Can you tell us about your concerns about these kind of minority ownerships and, you know, those shares maybe not being actually saleable? What's the worst that can happen? Because you could, like you said, maybe it's a good thing, but what's the worst that can happen?
Well, so if it's a privately owned operation, I generally feel a little less nervous on behalf of the employee, usually because they're owning equity at the same level as the majority owners. And we all know, and I don't know, I think it's more transparent in the sense that, look, I'm not here just trying to have a vehicle on which to make money. I'm here because I built this practice and I'm looking for a succession plan. It's not exactly the same motivation. And then the other thing is majority owners, they're still boots on the ground. They're still involved. They know you. They care. Generally, they care about you. You're not just a vehicle for them. And so in that case, and because the 1% is governed by the same document that everybody else is bound to, and generally also because the valuation that they get, you're going to get that same valuation either. You know, it's not layered or there's going to be preferential pricing, like so many potential mirrors and smoke screens that you're left, you know, holding one apple out of the apple tree instead of maybe a branch to which you were entitled to. So I think here the key is transparency and associates to say, look, I don't mind helping you get on the ride. I mean, success, I get it. I won't buy your practice. I can't buy it. I respect that you've built this from ground up. I respect that this was not easy. And I also value that I got to ride on this and that I'm part of this. And I would like to stay on And I hope that things won't change. But because I helped you build this and because I am a percentage owner, I also want to get rewarded for that. And so I need you to show me how I'm getting, you know, rewarded, you know, certainly as part of that. So I want full transparency. I want to see that letter of offer. And if you get millions and millions and millions of dollars, good for you. But I just want to make sure that I'm getting my 2% of that millions and millions of dollars. So that, again, it's full transparency. And how long do you want me to stay? And what type of non-compete do you want me to agree to? And I get that I'll have to do all of that. And I think one important thing in particular, and this is what majority owners should negotiate for the minority owners, and we've done this numerous times, is those minority owners should not have to sign the transaction documents and then be personally liable for liabilities of the business. So we tend to insulate minority owners from that. So the majority owners do, and they're personally liable, but the minority owners should not have to do that.
And I would think they should also not have to stay in order for those shares to pay out.
Absolutely.
Because I've seen some documents that are not at all equitable between majority and minority owners when they buy those shares.
I mean, they should stay 1 year. They should maybe stay 1 year, but not 3 to 5.
Right, right. Yeah. That's important. Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners about this whole process? There's a lot to it.
Well, hopefully this has gone a long way to educate your listeners. I think the thing that I'd like to leave is don't be afraid to ask pointed questions or specific questions and demand a specific answer. Not a fluffy answer that doesn't really answer your questions. Asking the right question is often more important than the answer. And so this is issue spotting and asking the right question so that you understand what you're getting yourself into. The other thing is you can hire, so these are called mergers and acquisitions attorneys. They're specific attorneys. This is pretty much all they do. You know, just like, you know, if you're in the dressage business or the hunter jumper or the 3-day event, like we can all inject a joint, but we might be looking for different things, suspensory injuries versus a joint injury, just because of the type of sport this horse participates in. Lawyers are the same thing. And so you want a mergers and acquisitions attorney that this is all they do because they can scan through one of these documents very quickly and have those questions answered for you rather than doing a deep dive and trying to figure it out and learn, along the way.
Is there a range of what that kind of legal help would cost somebody who is trying to decide whether or not they should do this transaction?
So those are not necessarily inexpensive attorneys, but, you know, I would say, you know, if you do firms that like do big time businesses, you know, it could be anywhere between $450 to $900 an hour, right? And you wouldn't hire the $900 an hour one, but you could, you know, and there's veterinary attorneys in our space. The advantage of that, too, is we're very familiar with a lot of these buyers already. So we kind of already know what their documents say. So we've already read them 3 or 4 times, maybe more. So, you know, certainly that helps. But what I would, I mean, that's a great end question. What I would also say is I would like a term sheet from your legal department. Not from you, from your legal department, that is an overview of what the terms of the partnership, because you are a partner, that specifically addresses these questions. And Dr. Grice, I gave you that list, so maybe, you know, and
yeah.
I know you're going to make it available. So I think, first of all, the attorneys, you know, they have to, so term sheets are actually done in, not so much in our industry, but they are others, that gives you the blueprint and then ask those questions and just ask for that.
That is so incredibly helpful. That's going to really, that's going to help people so much. I appreciate that because these are situations that no veterinarian, they know about medicine. This is not, they don't understand this. this is going to be such a helpful thing that you have shared, and I appreciate it so much. Thank you so much for joining us today, and thanks to all our listeners for joining us for the Business of Practice podcast, and a big thanks to our sponsor, Care Credit. And to all my listeners out there, be brave, embrace change.